In our life, we have choices, and we make them. Some are good choices, and some are not. I'm sure we remember them all, don't we? In a moment, we'll check in with Eldon Taylor. We're going to talk about choices and some of the things he's been working on lately on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Eldon Taylor, of course, has made a lifelong study of the human mind, has earned a doctoral degrees in psychology and metaphysics. He is a fellow at the American Psychotherapy Association. He is a non-denominational minister, president director of the Progressive Awareness Research. And for more than 20 years, his books, lectures, and appearances have approached personal empowerment. And he, of course, is a regular on Coast to Coast, Eldon Taylor. Eldon, how are you?
I'm excellent, sir. It's wonderful to join you again. You're my number one favorite of all times. You know that.
Well, you're one of the good guys.
Well, thank you, sir.
What have you been doing lately?
You know, I've been sharing. I guess that's the bottom line. I've spent this last year just intensely attempting to communicate, you know, some of what's been going on. I post every day on my Facebook page some new study, and the studies that are rolling out now, you know, we have this combination of social psychologists and neurologists and marketing professionals and, you know, politicians, and they're all looking at how they can persuade you and all the little nuances that are involved in that. So I find it more and more important that you know, we communicate to people just exactly how much of their thinking isn't really their own thinking.
Well, that's a good point. But, you know, we have, and I was just starting this by thinking about what you've been doing, the books you've written, Choices and Illusions, and, of course, you've updated that. We'll talk about that in a second. That people have choices. They make choices. Some are not good. Some are pretty good. How many times do we make these choices, Eldon, and then kick ourselves for the choices we made?
Well, I think that's a habitual pattern. The bottom line comes down to, well, let me say it differently. Krishnamurti said, choice arises as a result of confusion. If I know clearly there is no choice, it's only when I'm uncertain as to what to do that I have this illusion of a choice. In that uncertainty, and that goes right to the heart of what I like to talk about, in that uncertainty exists all this information that, for all intent and purposes, isn't necessarily authentic or original with ourselves. It's the information that we've taken out of our culture, the information that we've taken out of the media, the information that we've used to form who we are. And we're basing our decisions or our judgments on that information. It's, in fact, there's a wonderful story, George, if I may. I love to tell stories,
please,
because they can take complicated issues and make them really simple, and they stick with you. But, you know, we tend to think of our choices like, okay, do I do this or do I do that? Like we have a multiple choice question set in front of us, A, B, C. When indeed, you know, in reality, there's genuinely an entire alphabet out there, and you can assemble that alphabet into words, and those words into sentences, and those sentences into paragraphs, and on and on. So this story goes this way. You know, a young person makes a trip to New York City. It's the very first time. They've really wanted to go to New York. They've saved their money. They've fantasized about it, they've clipped postcards, etc., and they're finally there, and it's an absolutely glorious day. It's just gorgeous. The sky is clear, you can see forever, and they're just enjoying the day, and they just start walking through New York. And they wander off the main areas of shopping and into some of the housing areas, and then find themselves in a high-rise condo area, walking along the sidewalk when a flower pot falls from a third-story balcony.
Ugh.
Strikes him on the head, falls to the sidewalk, the charge scatter about, you know, the dirt, the plant, they're all broken out on the sidewalk.
He's got to be dead.
Well, you got a bump on your head. You've got a real good abrasion here, and you can feel that. And And, you know, and it stings. But you're okay. You know you're okay.
He lucked up.
But now you're going to make some choices. And, you know, George, when I ask audiences about this, I get three choices that always come forward. The first one is, you know, I'm going to take the charge of that pot. I'm going to take them upstairs to the owner, and I'm going to put them you know where. In other words, I'm going to get even.
Yeah.
You know? Of course, if you get up there, at least if it's me, and I find out it's the lineman for the New York Giants, I'll change my mind in a real hurry. And often, you know, we don't think things through. We just react out of anger, and we get ourselves into deeper trouble or make bad choices along that process. Now, another alternative is, and one that everybody puts forward, you know, this is a high-rise condo area, a very affluent area. This is a rich suburb, you know. Hey, I could have whiplash. This could be a concussion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be the opportunist. I'm going to sue this fat cat. I mean, his insurance company will settle before I even get a hold of an attorney. They're going to be that concerned about
it. Yeah, that's true.
Then there's a third alternative, you know, and we hear this a lot from people that tend to think that they're right where they are because that's where they're supposed to be, okay? So, you know, this alternative, I think, is denial because it goes this way. Well, you know, I'm not going to let this incident ruin my beautiful day. I mean, I'm okay. I know I'm okay. I'm just going to go on.
It was an accident.
After all, maybe this pot, you know, struck me and it was meant to be, and I'm going to have some special enlightenment as a result of it, huh? Well, and I think of that again as denial because there's nothing proactive in it. But if you then think, okay, well, what other options are there? What would be a really good option? An option that when I look back on it, I felt good about the event.
You buy the person a new pot and give it to them.
There you go. You know, what you do is you take that plant and you have it repotted. And you return it to the person, you know, hey, listen.
With your head all bandaged up.
Well, maybe that too, you know. But imagine the look on their face when you knock on the door and you say, you know, your pot fell from your balcony, but I didn't want your plant to die. So I repotted it for you. It kind of hurt my head,
yeah.
But, you know. When you put your head on the pillow that evening, of all those options, which one would be the option that would make you feel warm and fuzzy, that would give you those good feelings, that would put those good neurochemicals into your system? See, that becomes really obvious, but we tend not to think that way.
All right, well, let me rephrase it. Let me ask you this question.
Go.
What if the guy dropped the pot on your head on purpose?
And you returned it and knocked on his door. And he then hit you with it.
Yeah, see, then I'd take one of the other options.
Well, you know, there are folks like that in the world. You know, fortunately, unfortunately, there are those kinds of people in the world. I used to deal with them a lot. You know, I practiced criminalistics for years and years. I spent my day running lie detection tests and supervising investigations, doing a forensic hypnosis session or something of that nature. So, you know, I know firsthand that those folks exist. But I also know firsthand from working with inmates in maximum security that, you know, they all have this soft spot. They all have this spot that I think of as, you know, they recognize the difference between the eternal and the right now, here and now. You know, there's a marvelous story about a shooter who was, you know, he fled the scene and held up with a woman, and she had read Rick Warren's book, A Purpose-Driven Life, and she shared the book with him, and he ended up surrendering, giving himself up. I'm sure you know that story.
Yeah, we've heard that.
I have seen that kind of thing firsthand. I can remember being in a cell in maximum security at the Utah State Prison with an inmate who the week prior had been the perpetrator behind another inmate being life flighted out to a local hospital. He was a big guy. He was a mean guy. And he basically said to me, and I was in his cell alone with he and one other person, he said to me, "What is there that stops me from just plucking your head like a pimple?"
Jeez.
So I know these things happen and they go on firsthand. But, you know, here's my point. In every incident where I have met that kind of force or violence or threat with the gesture of kindness or love or acceptance, I've never had the force accelerate.
No, most of the time you're right, unless the person is a serial killer, mentally ill person.
And, you know, and if that's the instance, then, you know, there isn't much you can do.
There's no,
so
you can't.
If I've taken my flower pot back, and he is the guy you're talking about, I'm going to bet he melts on me. But if he doesn't melt on me, well, then I'm going to call 911.
And off you go. You know, when you wrote Choices and Illusions some time ago, what, 6, 7 years ago?
7 years ago, yes.
Now you're redoing part of it. How come? What's new?
Well, you know, again, after 5 or 6 years of lecturing around the country, talking to people about the book and my work, it became clear that as the science has advanced, there are more and more reasons for everyone to be aware of just how little of their own thinking that they're not doing. So, I mean, you know, the bottom line comes down to, we come back to, where did I get this idea? Where did I get the idea that I want to be who I am? And I don't agree with Nietzsche on most of anything that he's ever written, but in an essay called Twilight, he says, why is it we don't sit down and, you know, choose who we want to be? Choose the characteristics that we want to have about ourselves. You know, why is it that we don't sit down and say, well, I want to be an outgoing person. I want to be an honest person. I want to list out all the characters that we want and then adapt them and take them on. Instead of doing that, you know, we basically, you know, I have a whole set of chicken yard beliefs, and those chicken yard beliefs, they tend to provide the choices that we make. Well, listen, as the science has advanced, more and more methods are being developed that, for all intent and purposes, take advantage of what we don't know about ourselves. So what I wanted to do was provide a one-stop resource for people interested in the mind. Provide examples of the way our thoughts and beliefs affect every part of our lives, what happens when we have those thoughts that, you know, don't serve us, that negative self-talk that comes through, and provide some instructions for the pitfalls that we look out for so that we have some solid exercises to circumvent that, a good tool set to not just recognize it, but to circumvent it, to create the kind of us that we want. Yeah, look, I know that you deal with this every day.
All the
time.
I know
that you see it, but there are so many unhappy people in the world. There's so much disenchantment with everything, so much anxiety, heightened sense of arousal, this uncertainty that I think it's, you know, the most important thing that you can really do today is bring people's attention to the fact that they don't have to live that way. There is a better way. There are simple things that they can do that empower them to deal with whatever circumstances they have in their life, but to do so in a healthy, happy sort of way.
I get a kick, Eldon, at watching, for example, my grandchildren making choices. You sit back and you watch them and you don't want to really get involved. You don't want them hurt. You jump in when there's something like that. But just watching them try to figure out what to do and what to select and how to pick, it's really something just watching that.
You're right. And have you ever asked them, where did you get the idea to make that choice?
Yeah.
And when you do, what you find is, you know, they're mirroring it from somewhere. They'll give you a reason. They'll give you a story. And it's almost always a product of either exclusion or of copying. You know, that makes the very point. When you, one of the things that I like to do, like to show when I'm speaking, is something known as the nine-dot matrix.
Now, what is that?
Well, if you put nine dots up on a board in rows of three, so maybe just they're an inch apart. So you've got three of them,
mm-hmm.
inch apart.
Three, three, three.
And then three down, an inch apart. And you do it that way. And then if I say to you, connect those nine dots with four straight lines, 99 out of 100 or more people will stumble and stumble and stumble, totally unable to connect the nine dots. Now, just kind of create a visual image, if you don't have a piece of paper and you're listening to this show, of those nine dots, okay? You've got three.
Let me tell you how I do it right now.
Okay.
I would do, you got your nine dots. I would do an X, and then one down the middle on the horizontal and vertical. And they're all connected right in the middle.
Okay, but you want to connect them so they're all connected.
All the way around?
All the way around. With
oh,
the four.
Boy.
So if you do that, you know, let's say you start at the bottom one on the left, and you draw up to the top one, and then you draw across the top there, and then you draw down. Well, you still have two dots and only one line. You see that?
So what does this mean?
Okay, well, here's the story. Those nine dots have within them an implicit boundary. In other words, you didn't need to stop when you went to that top dot. If you were to draw, and I hope you have actually drawn this one down, George. If you were to draw a line through and past that first.
You just don't stop.
That's right. And then back. And then over, you can easily connect them.
That's how you tricked us.
Yeah. and that's something that if you get far enough along in the IQ test, you're going to run into that. But people get stuck because they see implicit boundaries. They see limitations where limitations aren't there. And we begin that process when we're really very young. It is... all a part of how we're enculturated. So, you know, it is fun to watch children make these decisions, but what I like to do is actually sit down with them and ask them why they're doing that, and even if I can, suggest, well, are there any other possibilities? One of the great things that people should be doing with children, in my view, is giving them the opportunity to brainstorm like you would if you were in a Fortune 500 company, where one idea or two ideas are not sufficient. We want every idea that we can get.
They pick a couple good ones.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
We used to do that.
But that's not ordinarily how we see people live their lives. They live their lives out of an automatic process. You know, I have a friend that's a psychologist in Utah. And bless his heart, he's in the hospital right now.
Oh,
I'm really worried about the guy because we're not sure he's going to come out. But, I've known him for many, many years, Charles McCusker. And he told me, before he kissed his first date, that he practiced kissing his pillow maybe 100 times. You know, as human beings, what we do is we practice our behavior. As young children, we may stand in front of a mirror and, we pose ourselves. If it's a Clint Eastwood movie that we see, maybe we are holding our fingers out saying, go ahead and make my day. But we're rehearsing a behavior. And we're rehearsing it typically from some imprinting model that we take out of the media. And we rehearse it enough that it becomes automatic. And that automatic behavior then frames our decisions. There's a marvelous, marvelous anecdote that portrays that Richard Bach tells. It tells the story of a man who's hypnotized on a stage.
Hold on. We'll get right back to that. Then I want to talk with you about bad choices as well. Eldon Taylor with us tonight on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're with Eldon Taylor. He has revised his best-selling book, Choices and Illusions, Things Change, and he keeps on top of those things. Eldon, you were going to tell us a story about hypnosis. What happened?
Yeah, well, it's a great platform to understand something that I think deals with how most people live their lives. It's a story Richard Bach put forward. He basically says this. You know, you've got a subject. The subject is on a stage. A hypnotist has just hypnotized him. There's an entire audience watching. Now, this subject is told that they're in a very safe bunker. This bunker is 10 by 10. It's a palm bunker. Nothing can happen to them in this bunker. They are completely protected in the bunker. And the hypnotist asks the subject to walk from wall to wall. It's 10 feet this way and 10 feet that way. And the subject does that. And when they reach that 10 feet, somehow they know that wall is there. And they stop and they push on that wall. And they check all four walls out. And then the hypnotist says, now, you know, there are no windows in here. There's no doors. This is completely sealed room. You're completely, you need to get out of this room. There's a danger. Find a way out of the room. Well, the audience laughs while this hypnotized individual is pounding his imaginary walls with his hands and is unable to get out and is absolutely frantic. And when he's about to just be overcome with fear, then the hypnotist wakes him. Well, most of us, or many of us, I should say, live our lives in part that way. We circumscribe our lives with imaginary beliefs. And these imaginary beliefs, for all intent and purposes, are the self-limiting beliefs that stop us from moving beyond those boundaries, the boundaries that we see in this self-imposed boundary that existed in the nine-dot matrix we were talking about before the break.
Eldon, a lot of us make choices, and we make bad choices. Are they considered mistakes or merely bad choices?
Well, you know, I think what we have to understand is a little more about ourselves. I mean, first of all, we're going to have our own biases. We have all kinds of biases that predispose why we might make a bad decision. It's our subconscious that wants to trick us as much as anything. And indeed, the research now shows us that some 90% of our decisions are actually made in the subconscious mind. And as you and I spoke not long ago, functional magnetic resonance imaging shows us that an fMRI technician watching you make a decision can know what you're going to decide 6 to 10 seconds before you know. So, and that should startle everybody. But if we understand then, okay, there's a script going on in our subconscious, and that script includes some self-serving biases, then those self-serving biases are also, they have underneath them a foundation that's built in habit. And our habits, they propel much of our decision-making. So, you know, there's a story that Professor King told me once about how he was working on breaking a habit. I think that makes this point very well. Story goes this way. Very much overweight, and decided that what he wanted to do was shed some of those pounds. Mm-hmm. And the way for him to do that, he decided, was to give up Krispy Kreme donuts, because he ate a dozen of them every day.
A dozen a day.
So he had moved to a new community, and there was no Krispy Kreme in town. He had to get on the freeway and go down the road about 5 miles to the Krispy Kreme. So he just decided, I'll give up Krispy Kreme. It's out of town. It'll be easy for me. And for the first 60 days or so, that worked fine.
Out of sight, out of mind, right?
That's right. But then, you know, the day came that he had to get on the freeway and leave town. And as he did so, as he ended up on the freeway, he thought, oh, Krispy Kreme, I'm going to pass Krispy Kreme. Then he started this dialogue in his head. Well, you know, you're not going to stop. We don't have Krispy Kreme anymore. Well, but, you know, maybe I could just have one donut. Well, you know you wouldn't have one donut.
They're like peanuts.
Well, then we could just have a cup of coffee. No, you know that if you stop for coffee, you'll be getting a donut. And this conversation carried on as he realized he had exited and was pulling into the parking lot at Krispy Kreme. That's how automatic some of our behavior can be.
Sure.
You know, we also tend, you know, to have a need for immediate gratification. And so often we'll make decisions to do something because we have convinced ourselves we deserve it, or, well, we'll be able to figure it out, or, well, everybody else has. We'll find a rational way to justify our need for immediate gratification. But I said rational way, and I should really put that word in quotation marks, because when we're talking about these kinds of things, we can be really irrational in our process. We have all kinds of compensation mechanisms, and sometimes we make decisions out of anger or as a result of compensatory mechanisms or as a result of compliance.
Or know? Fear.
Or fear. You know, I see anger and fear as basically a circular loop, but and we may talk about that later, but we also have all these compliance mechanisms that have been well defined by social psychologists. So we know that, for example, the principle of reciprocity, if I give you a gift, you're going to feel that you have a debt to me.
Yes.
If I get you to place a small sign in your window supporting some cause, you are 10 times more likely to put a billboard on your front yard 30 days later just to demonstrate your compliance with your earlier decision, your consistency. We have this need for consistency. Most people recognize most compliance principles like scarcity and our drives and justification, but all of these things, George, are operating at an unconscious level. And so many of the decisions that we're making that we look at and we say this wasn't a very good decision, they're the result of unconscious processes, unconscious biases, and that's in part why I wrote the book. I mean, if you understand that these things function, if you understand, case in point, let's say I wanted to move your value system some, just a little bit.
Up or down?
Well, let's put liberal on one end of the scale, and we'll put conservative on the other. So we're not going to go up or down. We're going to go left to right, or right to left, depending on how you like it. If I were to sit you at a table and ask you the same set of questions, but with when I ask you, I have on the table a bottle, a jar of hand sanitizer, your answers are going to tend to be much more conservative than if I don't have that jar of hand sanitizer on the table.
Why?
Well, because that sanitizer serves as an unconscious prime. It is priming a symbol. What is hand sanitizer? You know, hand sanitizer is how I remain clean, pure, and so forth. This is how I disinfect. There's nothing liberal about hand sanitizer. There's a lot of research today that is pointing to a difference, an anatomical difference in our brains that predisposes us to be liberal or conservative.
Are you saying conservatives are more are cleaner than liberals?
Well, no. What I'm not that at all. Conservatives tend, however, to be more inclined to look for dangers. They're more attentive to those kinds of processes than liberals. Liberals tend to be more adventuresome. So the hand sanitizer is a psychological prime that tends to move you toward the conservative side simply because of its symbolism. Take it off the table, and you'll answer the questions differently. Well, now let's assume I know that, and there's a whole lot more. I mean, the science of this comes out on a daily basis. And as much as I like to write about it and post about it, it's sometimes overwhelming. I mean, what we're learning about how easy it is to manipulate a human being. But let's assume that I've done this with a hand sanitizer. Now you have a consistency, compliance principle, which simply means, okay, you've answered that way now, so now I'm going to come back to you, and I'm going to extend that by asking you why you answered that way. Your need for consistency will give rise to you inventing, if necessary, the reasons. And you'll never be aware that it was the hand sanitizer that was the prime.
Just sitting there on the table.
Just sitting on the table. And there are all sorts of these primes that, you know, again, we're learning. In fact, you know, you can think of fMRI, which is a way to look at the brain lifetime, as not just being a tool of medicine today. It is a tool of marketing. It's a tool that allows us to watch the brain lifetime as it responds to different sorts of stimulus.
Is this what you call neuromarketing?
That is called neuromarketing. You're right.
Huh. And they have learned, spend billions of dollars on this, don't they?
Yeah, hundreds of billions of dollars. It is an incredible business. It has really taken off since Edward Bernays and some of the information Bernays left us with in his book, Propaganda. It is a major big business. And whether it's a politician or it's a product salesman, you're a fool not to be aware of this if you're spending any money on trying to win the so-called hearts and minds of the American public or anyone else for that matter. In this last election, there was quite a bit of conversation about what has been called the social psychologist dream team that served President Obama in framing literally every word that his
they did a great job.
Phone canvassers did. Of course they did. I mean, they put a context and a frame on everything, including their opposition. And it was a brilliant job. But the people that were behind doing that are some of the best in the areas of social psychology that spend their days doing nothing more than calculating ways that they can manipulate people, that they can cause people to be motivated or to respond favorably.
They're still doing it to us, aren't they?
Oh, yes, more so. Like I say, you know, that is probably the fastest growing area of psychology right now. Understanding once we got a picture of how easy it is to mobilize human behavior by the simplest of devices, like the hand sanitizer or, you know, that beautiful woman draped over an automobile. I mean, that's a very interesting kind of study, because here you can take a beautiful woman, scantily dressed, place her, you know, draped on an automobile, over the hood of the automobile.
In little cutoffs.
Yeah.
They did that with Megan Fox when she started out.
And men will judge that automobile to be faster than other automobiles.
You mean they'll buy that car based on that scene?
That's right. And you know, here's the
amazing.
If you show them the, you know, say you had four automobiles with the woman on one, and you show them the same four automobiles but with a woman on a different one, a week later, they'll go with the different car. And even when you point it out to them, they'll have a reason to justify it that has nothing to do with that scantily clad young lady.
It's just locked into their heads.
Well, it is. I mean, you know, this is all a part of understanding how the human vehicle works, how the mind works. And, you know, most people have spent very, very little time in their lives really understanding who they are or how they got where they got.
Once you understand that, how can you use that in your day-to-day life?
Well, the first thing that happens is, of course, once you understand it, you begin to guard against it. You begin to become aware. You begin to realize that, you know, these kinds of manipulations are going to go on, and I need to be vigilant about it. And that's probably your only sense of defense. And even with that said, even being vigilant, the best of us can become subject to it. We can know that it's happening. There's a couple of examples. Let me give those to you. There's a very famous scene that's on the internet. You can find it at YouTube. This is the conspic conspicuous gorilla that comes across the middle of the screen while you're counting balls. People that watch this fail to see the gorilla.
How could you miss the gorilla?
Because you are so focused, so concentrated on what it is that you're doing that you miss it completely. That kind of concentration, when you're concentrating on a thing, happens to even the best of us, the experts that know better. Let me give you another example. There's an area of the brain, well, there are multiple areas, but the areas of the brain that, for all intent and purposes, tend to discrimination. We know, turn off, to use the words of PET or MRI folks, in the presence of an authority. So you're standing with your physician, and your physician is telling you something, and you're listening to that physician, and instead of discriminating, assessing what he's saying, determining whether or not you're going to accept it or not, that area of your brain is turned off. You're just taking it in as though it must be that way. There is no other alternative. Okay?
All right, I'm with you.
Now, I know that. I know that to be a fact. But still, when I saw my physician 3 or 4 months ago, and he started to tell me some things, I had to remind myself, hold it, wait a minute. And so what I ended up doing is I said, wait, doc, let me tell you something. You know, there's a marvelous study, and I explained to him the study, which was my way of reminding myself, pay attention here. Just because I am being told this doesn't mean that's how it is. Apply that discrimination. So what can happen when we know this is that we gain our greatest potential defense. If we know the information and then we decide to be proactive, we decide to access all the beliefs that we have that may be the limiting beliefs, the kinds of beliefs that stop us from experiencing our potential. One of the best ways to begin to do that is to become mindful. And that's a process of just attending to that stream of consciousness that's coming into my mind all the time, that self-talk. As I become aware of the self-talk, I will begin to get a mirror on what I actually believe.
Well, Eldon, hold on for a sec. We're at the top of the hour. Let's come back and talk more about choices on Coast to Coast AM.